Please join me in a spirit of prayer and meditation. Spirit of life and love, great spirit, great mystery. We come together to celebrate the good times of our lives and to hold one another in the hard ones. We come together to learn and to seek the truth, to acknowledge and accept that we as individuals and as a nation have and continue to fall short of our stated ideals and aspirations. But let us not stop there, but to comfort the brokenhearted and begin to heal the world. Let us hold this moment in silence. So be it, and amen.
Our ancient reading is by Charles A. Eastman, whose Wahpeton Sioux name was Oiyesha. From childhood, I was consciously trained to be a man. That was, after all, the basic thing. But after this, I was trained to be a warrior and a hunter, and not to care for money or possessions, but to be, in the broadest sense, a public servant. After arriving at a reverent sense of the pervading presence of the spirit and giver of life, and a deep consciousness of the brotherhood of man, the first thing for me to accomplish was to adapt myself perfectly to natural things. In other words, to harmonize myself with nature. To this end, I was made to build a body both symmetrical and enduring, a house for the soul to live in, a sturdy house, defying the elements. I must have faith and patience. I must learn self-control and be able to maintain silence. I must do with as little as possible and start with nothing most of the time, because a true Indian always shares whatever he may possess. Our modern reading is by poet Nilla North Sun, whose grandma has complained that her grandchildren don't speak Indian. Her reply was, "But grandma, you told your daughters, marry white men, told them they would have nicer houses, fancy cars, pretty clothes, could live in the city." "Grandma, your daughters did. They couldn't speak Indian anymore. How could we grandchildren learn? There are no rabbits to skin in the city. We have no grandma there to teach us the ways."
It isn't easy being a Unitarian Universalist. But it is good. We seem to feel deeply the injustices and tribulations of our country and our world. And as UUs, we stand back and we say, when I look at the world and I see things that I see, I can't just stand here. I have to do something. And we try. We try very hard to make the world a better place. And sometimes we even succeed. But what can we do about injustices and tribulations that happened more than 100 years ago, or 300 years ago, or 5? Is there anything that can be done to right those wrongs? The National Unitarian Universalist Association is posing those questions right now in connection with the movement that is working to change the Columbus Day holiday into what is called Indigenous Peoples Day. The UUA is asking us to help create this new commemoration as a justice issue. The movement had its origins in 1977 when a delegation of Native nations attended the United Nations-sponsored International Conference on Discrimination Against Indigenous Peoples in the Americas. That conference passed a resolution to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. And Native peoples and their allies have been working toward that goal ever since. The movement wants to shine a light on aspects of this country's history that have been hidden from view, to have this country make a public acknowledgement of some unfortunate facts. Many Americans are not aware of these historical facts and would probably rather not think or talk about them. The Indigenous Peoples Day movement gathered some momentum in 1990, 2 years before the 500th anniversary of Columbus's landing in the Western Hemisphere, when representatives from 120 Indian nations from all over the Americas met in Quito, Ecuador, in the first Continental Conference on 500 years of Indian resistance. At that conference, a representative of the mayor of Berkeley, California, gathered the information that led the city of Berkeley and some nearby cities to affirm October 12, 1992, as International Day of Solidarity with Indigenous Peoples. Today, this day of solidarity is still celebrated in those cities, as well as in the states of South Dakota, Hawaii, and Alabama, and many other cities, including Phoenix, Arizona. And the movement continues to this day, encouraged within our denomination by the UUA's recent request. Back in the 1980s, I was a fiery political activist out in Southern California. And one thing that fanned the flames of my activism was a book by Howard Zinn called A People's History of the United States. The first chapter focuses on Christopher Columbus and the conquistadors Cortez and Pizarro, and it also talks about the English arrival and settlement of North America. I don't know if you're familiar with the people's history, but when I first read it, I was horrified. Like most people, I was brought up on the notion that America was a place of ideals, a place that had tried hard from the very beginning to adhere to a powerful moral principles of equality and liberty. But in my youth, some of that began to collapse when I became conscious of racism directed toward African Americans. I began to realize that we had flaws as a nation, some of them glaring. But I was hardly prepared for the alternate view of history described by Howard Zinn. His carefully researched, fact-filled account presented a very different perspective on our nation's origins. He described a history so bloody, so painfully brutal, and heartlessly cruel that I actually had to stop reading. The cruelty began with the arrival of the first Europeans on our shores. There was nothing heroic, honorable, or even Christian in the way the first Europeans interacted with the people that they found here. Instead, they ran roughshod over the indigenous people, who, according to firsthand accounts, including Columbus's journals and others, were primarily peaceful, and who welcomed the Europeans with generous hospitality. In the book Soul Works, published by the UUA's Beacon Press, professor and theologian George Tinker talks about Columbus Day. Dr. Tinker is a member of the Osage Nation and also a Lutheran minister with Unitarian tendencies. He describes the time that he joined 2,000 other protesters to protest Columbus Day in Denver, Colorado. He says, "We did not engage in our protest because of what Columbus did, which was indeed bad enough, but because of what Columbus symbolizes for white America." Dr. Tinker goes on to say that as governor of the Indies, Columbus was directly responsible for the death of some 4 million Aboriginal people who were owners of the land he invaded during his first 8 years in the Western Hemisphere, 1492 to 1500. Dr. Tinker says that Columbus plays a highly symbolic role in American history, that he is seen as the quintessential white American hero. He says that this view is clearly illustrated by the way the news media reported on the Columbus Day protest in Denver. The media said that the Indians allege that Columbus was a slave trader and a murderer, and thus diminished the legitimacy of the protesters. Tinker says, "Of course, we protesters, Indian and non-Indian people together, do not allege these things about Columbus. The man murdered people and shipped enslaved Indians back to the slave markets in Seville. These are facts. No one allows the press today to say that Jews allege that Hitler killed 6 million Jews." It is hard to hear these stories. I think the United States, and probably many other countries, suffer from a kind of cultural amnesia. The Indigenous Peoples' Day movement is trying to help cure that affliction. The movement is trying to bring the truth to light, because once something has come to light, it can no longer be said, "Well, I just didn't know." It's no longer so easy to hide behind our innocence and our ignorance. But these words of Adrienne Rich came to me this morning. "My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world." And so I spent some time learning about the Indigenous People's Day movement. My research began by learning about the Indigenous people of this area, and I became intrigued by their story. I started learning more about New Jersey and its earliest history. I began to learn what really happened here in my state so many long ago, and I began to gain a new appreciation for the land that we walk on every day, an appreciation for the ground under my feet. Here are some of the facts. In 1524, Giovanni de Veranzo was the first European to sail into what we now call New York Harbor. On this voyage, he made contact with an indigenous people called the Lenape. The Lenape called this land Lenapehoking, land of the Lenape, which included all of New Jersey, part of Delaware, eastern Pennsylvania, southeastern New York State, and a small part of Connecticut. The Lenape were divided into three groups, loosely associated more by language than by any political arrangement. There was a group called the Uname, who lived downriver, the Unalachtigo, that is, people who live near the ocean, and the Munsee, the people of the northern region, who were called people of the stone country. They were a matrilineal people whose archaeological history can be documented back at least 10,000 years, when mastodons and saber-toothed tigers and giant sloths roamed the land. They were living here during the last ice age, a time when the coast of New Jersey extended out another 50 miles into the ocean. Global warming has indeed been taking place for a long time. Many of the Lenape depended upon the Delaware and its tributaries, and eventually became known as the Delaware Indians. I was interested to learn that the river was actually named after Thomas West, 3rd Baron de La Warr, an English nobleman, I had always thought that Delaware was an Indian word. For thousands of years, the Lenape moved across the land in rhythm with the seasons, following the herds of deer and other game, and foraging for plant foods like berries and acorns. About 2,600 years ago, two major developments occurred. The Lenape learned how to make objects out of clay and how to farm. They learned how to grow the three sisters, beans, corn, and squash. Now they could stay in a place long enough to build permanent dwellings called wigwams. The men would leave these early villages for weeks at a time to hunt or to seek a particular kind of stone needed to make tools and cooking utensils. The Lenape lived in close relationship with the earth. This was not a romantic ideal. The earth literally was the mother who sustained life, and they gave thanks for her bounty. They developed a theology of gratitude that pervaded every aspect of their daily lives. When they woke in the morning, they went directly to the water to wash their face and then to wade out into it to give thanks for the day. Out of this sense of gratitude grew a culture of generosity and hospitality. The Lenape welcomed everyone and shared what they had with anyone. It was considered a disgrace not to. In the 1600s, the Dutch, the Swedes, the Finns, and the English encountered the Lenape Indian population. The Europeans and the indigenous Americans represented two completely different ways of viewing and operating in the world. The Europeans were seeking wealth and were motivated by profit. Fur was all the rage in Europe at that time, and so initially the Europeans traded with the Indians for fur pelts. It wasn't very long before the fur and pelt-bearing animals were trapped out. Once that happened, the Europeans had little interest in the Indians and moved on. The Lenape were left behind, but the animals were gone from their land. There was nothing left to hunt for food. Many Lenape died of starvation, but many, many, many others died from illnesses carried by the Europeans, such as smallpox and measles, diseases the Indian immune system had never encountered. Many estimate that 90% of the native population died during the 17th century. Meanwhile, the Old World was sending shiploads of colonists across the sea. These new arrivals wanted land. During the 1700s, most of the Lenape were pushed off the land that had been theirs throughout the millennia. They dispersed to the Midwest, to Wisconsin and Kansas, and to the north, Ontario, Canada. A small number remained here in New Jersey, most confined to a parcel of land called the Brotherton Reservation, which was run by Moravian missionaries. In 1801, the reservation was sold to the state of New Jersey, along with the Lenape hunting and fishing rights. The 63 remaining Lenape, yes, just 63 people, who lived on the reservation, joined their predecessors in Wisconsin. This is not the end of the story. The Lenape who had moved to the Midwest were displaced again in 1867 when new settlers arrived and claimed the land. The Lenape were invited by the Cherokee to join them in Indian Territory in Oklahoma, where many remain today. Yes, there are Lenape, the grandfathers, as they are still called out of respect. They are still alive in New Jersey, in Oklahoma, and Canada. This dissemination and displacement of population, language, and culture wreaked havoc among the native peoples all across this land. Their heartbreak showed up and shows up as depression, alcoholism, poverty, shorter life expectancy. But like many oppressed people, their spirit survived underground. In the late 1880s, a Paiute named Wokovac had a vision of a dance that would unite the native peoples. In his vision, the dance, which he called the Ghost Dance, would cause the earth to open up and swallow the white people. The natives would then be restored to their revitalized homelands. The practice of the Ghost Dance spread throughout many nations. When it spread to the Lakota, the Bureau of Indian Affairs became extremely nervous. Tension grew to a tragic peak on December 29, 1890, when the U.S. 7th Cavalry opened fire on the Lakota, killing over 300 unarmed men, women, and children at the Wounded Knee Massacre. This crushed the spirit and dashed the hopes of the Native people across this land for many decades. Then, in the 1950s, the federal government decided it was time to move Indians off their reservations and into urban areas. The Indians knew that this would inevitably mean the end of their way of life. They began to work together and formed the American Indian Movement. It took more than a decade, but in 1972, an organized group of Native Americans made a list of demands and presented them in Washington, D.C. to officials of the U.S. Department of Interior. It's not clear if it was a direct result of this action, but in 1978, the Congress passed the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, and for the first time, gave Native Americans the right to practice their religious beliefs. Since that time, a new wave of revitalization has been spreading throughout Native populations. It is reflected in many ways, including meetings that are still called powwows, which celebrate through dancing, drumming, and crafts. In fact, Lenape Indian powwows have been taking place in New Jersey for the past 32 years. Dr. Ronald Yanaguska Holloway is currently the chief of the New Jersey-based Lenape tribe and is today petitioning the state for Lenape hunting and fishing rights that his people lost so many years ago. Dr. Tinker estimates that for every year that it took to destroy Native American culture, it will take an equal number of years to rebuild. I figure we're in year 519 since Columbus landed on the shores of the Bahamas. If Dr. Tinker is right, and we stop the hurt and harm today, we have 519 years of work to do. That puts us in 2530. So we can't expect it to happen in our lifetime, and we don't even know what such a rebuilding might look like. But let us be hopeful. It may actually have started in 1990 in Quito, Ecuador, at the conference on 500 years of Indian resistance. That would put us 21 years into recovery. We all need to start. We all need to start that recovery. And I think that there are a few places where we might begin. A few ideas that came to mind were starting to treat the earth with reverence. That might be a good place to start. Teaching our children to value the earth, to simply notice and appreciate the world around them, to tell the truth about our history, to give Native people the time and space to sort through their own difficulties while giving them the right to self-determination. What if we just think about this year and start now? Start with this year as a year of restoration. The irony is that many of us, right here in this congregation, are now seeking earnestly to live simply and ethically to live in harmony with the earth, seeking to realize the powerful idea that the generous people who lived here 519 years ago were more than willing to share with us. And you know what the amazing thing is? They still are. From the Navajo, "Beauty is before me, and beauty behind me, beauty above me, beauty below me. I am surrounded by it. I am immersed in it. In beauty, it is begun. In beauty, it is ended." As we extinguish our chalice, our worship has ended. Let our service begin.